and the Annie E. Casey Foundation.
Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to hear Florida This Week from this past Friday night. It's a program about state and local politics. We're going to talk about some of the big issues in Florida in the last 7 days, including big changes at the Florida Supreme Court. Later on, we're going to have a guest in the studio. Sean Shaw will be here. He ran for attorney general in the state of Florida during the last election. He's going to be talking about those changes at the Florida Supreme Court, too. As we listen back to the program today, you can email your comments in. Our address is dj@wmnf.org. Here is Florida This Week. Coming up next, another mass shooting in Florida. Governor Ron DeSantis picks another conservative for Florida's highest court. The government shutdown continues, with workers facing another week without paychecks. And there were warnings of problems for air travelers. And John Morgan wants to boost the minimum wage across the state. Political insights next on Florida This Week. Welcome back. This week our panelists are Maya Brown is a political strategist and a Democrat. Danny Alvarez is a lawyer and a Republican. Daryl Paulson is the professor emeritus of government at USF St. Petersburg. And Amy Holyfield is the senior deputy editor for news at the Tampa Bay Times. Wonderful to have you here. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Well, there was another mass shooting this week in Florida, this time in Sebring, where a 21-year-old former prison guard trainee gunned down five women in a bank, four employees and a customer. The people in the small town just east of Sarasota in the middle of the state are in mourning. Reporters could find no criminal record for the gunman, who was originally from Indiana. His father said he was shocked by his son's actions, but a former girlfriend said the suspect liked guns, had a fascination with killing, and got kicked out of school for having a dream that he killed everyone in his class. The bank attack was at least the fourth mass shooting in Florida, resulting in five or more deaths in the past 3 years. A gunman killed 49 at an Orlando nightclub in 2016, five died at the Fort Lauderdale Airport in 2017, and 17 died in February of last year at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School near Fort Lauderdale. Danny, another senseless tragedy. Everybody wonders what can be done to prevent it. Is this something that we've just got to get used to, or are these things preventable? And why do they continue to happen?
Well, first off, you know, our hearts go out to the families of Sebring. This is, in my mind, an avoidable tragedy. The question is, can you prevent evil? The answer to that is no. The question is, how do you mitigate that? What we keep doing and we keep repeating ourselves, and it's like there's a big elephant in the room and we hear it breathing down our neck, but we will not address the fact that mental illness is the leading factor. In this case, again, we've got a guy who his girlfriend says, I was nervous, he had these fascinations, she started to report him, and we ignored it. But the thing is, police hands are tied, judges' hands are tied, because we don't have the authority to really go in and fund mental health, fund the efforts to make sure that we get these right kind of screenings. This isn't a gun issue. Florida has so many guns. Every single day you're sitting with and around guns, they never jump out at you, they never shoot you, because they are not the evil thing. The evil or crazy thing is the person, and we really have to address that. Can we do some things for guns? I'm sure, and gun owners are one of the first people to say, hey, I'm for all for background checks, and they want responsible gun ownership. But Rob, we need responsible gun ownership with mental health addressed.
All right, so you're saying treat the mental health problem. What about letting people who have mental illness buy guns? Should we intervene in that?
If you look at the one of the very questions in your background check in your that already exists today is, do you have a mental illness or have you ever been adjudicated of having a mental illness?
So how did this guy get a gun?
So he clearly didn't go through the right screenings, or something got missed, or someone said, I think that guy's a little off, but couldn't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. You know, we say things like, see something, say something, but we always ignore it. And people get scared because, look, down in Parkland, people called, said, this guy's crazy, he's gonna do something, and we ignored it. Stop ignoring the problem. It's not about guns. Guns are the way it happened. It'll be a knife, it'll be a truck, it'll be someone's hands.
Mario, what do you think? I mean, at what point should somebody raise their voice and say, I know somebody who's mentally ill, who's talked about committing violence in the past, and this person has a gun? At what point should people speak out about it?
Look, I think mental illness is definitely one of the clear collaborations or clear direction to why we have gun violence in our country. But I think that's really reactive to say that we only treat mental illness. Every legislative session, we have this conversation about how we're going to address gun issues and gun prevalence. But the conversation has been, how do we expand access to guns instead of how do we address the fact that we have high capacity magazines and assault weapons on our streets? And I appreciate that we have leadership in the Florida legislature now who is going to hold our feet to the fire to make sure that we move forward on this issue.
In the legislature this year, there's a move to put guns on college campuses. They're going to try that again this year.
They are, and I think that's a really irresponsible way to handle this problem. And I think that we've seen that, especially leaders in Central Florida, where Pulse happened, like Representative Escamondi and Representative Guillermo Smith, have said over and over again that we need to make sure that we have a surefire way to ensure that there is a process by which people get and can have guns. I mean, in the last gubernatorial election cycle, we saw that Commissioner Putnam, there was a dereliction of duty there in terms of how people got their guns, and that there were a number of people who shouldn't have had them. So we definitely have to make sure that any loopholes there are cleaned up.
You speak about Escamondi from Orlando. She was inundated with phone calls this week, hate calls, because she supports a ban on assault weapons. I mean, there's clearly an active group of people that don't like any sort of attempt to ban certain guns.
Yeah, and this one goes further than past legislation because it calls for the relinquishing of any assault weapons by July 1st of 2020, and the other bills haven't done that yet, so that's just going to be another obstacle in the way of trying to get this passed. The couple of scary things about this to me, one is that this individual served as a training prison guard at Avon Park Correctional Facility for 2 months, and how did he ever get in that position? Why did he leave? There's nothing so far that's come out that he was asked to leave or anything like this. The other thing is, there's no connection yet that I've seen as to why this event even took place. Did he know any of these individuals? Was this just a random act of violence by somebody who wanted to make a name for himself? And that's the difficult thing, that you can't legislate. What do you do with crazy people who just want to make a celebrity of themselves?
So, Amy, are we stuck? I mean, Daryl said we can't legislate. I think that was also Danny's position, too. We got to deal more with mental illness, Danny says. There are some people in the legislature that do want to ban certain kinds of weapons, but are we stuck?
I think it's just going to continue to be a conversation. There's always going to be something that's going to happen that's going to make us think differently. Honestly, one of the things that's going to happen in this legislative session stems from Parkland. That report, we're still dealing with Gualtieri's recommendation, the Pinellas Sheriff, that we arm teachers, that's the move we need to make. Mm-hmm. And so this is something we're going to talk about all the time. Just going forward.
And Gualtieri has changed his tune on this. Before he was the head of this commission, he was against the idea. He's come forward. He now thinks it's a good idea to have these armed guards in K-12 schools.
Right. It's a big change. The legislation that the legislature passed last year had to deal with staff, not teachers specifically. So that would be something that they would have to take up to be able to change it. But yeah, he talks about how much it affected him to sit through all those hearings and hear and see and watch the videos of Parkland, and how that made him think we got to do better by the people.
There were some minor gun control reforms passed by the legislature last year in the wake of Parkland. Now there's a move in the legislature to try to undo some of those. Is that for real up there in Tallahassee?
I mean, Maya said it. I mean, this is a legislature that has done nothing but try to expand access to guns, and leadership hasn't changed. It's Republican. I don't see that effort stopping. Mm-hmm.
So maybe the only thing everybody can agree on is more treatment for mental health, but Danny, you're not in favor of any sort of gun control legislation.
When we talk about gun control, I'm talking about responsible gun ownership. Absolutely. Yeah. Should we have guns in the hands of crazy people? Absolutely not. Should we have guns in the hands of people who shouldn't have them? That'll be up to our legislature to decide what that medium is. But the reality is until we address mental illness and we figure out what is causing these people, this common thread in each one of these mass shootings, then we're ignoring the very thing that's causing it in the first place.
But even the state legislature is having issues in terms of addressing this issue, and the gun lobby has such a hold on our legislature that they're preempting local government in terms of how they're responding to that. And so if local governments, our counties and cities, had the opportunity to address this issue, I think we'd be a lot further in this process, in this conversation.
All right. Well, Republican Governor Ron DeSantis has chosen a top official from the Trump administration to fill the third and final seat now open on the Florida Supreme Court. DeSantis chose Carlos Muniz for the High Court. Muniz has been working as general counsel for the U.S. Department of Education, which is led by Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. Muniz has never served as a judge, but worked as a top attorney for former Florida Governor Jeb Bush and was a chief of staff for former Attorney General Pam Bondi. With the latest appointment, conservatives say Florida now has the most conservative Supreme Court in the country. Daryl, would you agree? We now have the most conservative Supreme Court in the country, and is that a good thing or a bad thing for Floridians?
I would say there's no way to know. I mean, they haven't done anything yet, so how can you tell? And oftentimes, judges are appointed to positions who hand down decisions that are substantially different than what people expected of them. Go ask President Eisenhower about Earl Warren and his decisions. Nobody expected that. And there's a long list of judges like that. But you have to say DeSantis has appointed three judges to the court. It has changed the ideological makeup, at least on paper, of the court. Most people think it's a 6-1 conservative to liberal majority now. But people ought to remember there was a long period of time where you had Democratic governors who appointed these individuals to the Florida Supreme Court, and there was Democratic dominance on the court, even at a time when Florida voters had clearly swung to the Republican side, and people said, well, that doesn't reflect the will of the electorate. So you're going to get those kinds of situations. Part of this, too, is Betsy DeVos. He was associated with her, and that's sort of a lightning rod for Democrats. The head of the Florida Democratic Party, Terry Rizzo, said Munoz has no respect for the rule of law. I just think that's sort of a bizarre statement. This guy is a graduate of Yale Law School. Some of his strongest support comes from Democrats, one of whom was the attorney who represented the victim in the Jameis Winston case at FSU. And he said that he found the newest nominee to the court to be very respectful, very deliberative, precisely the kind of guy that he wants to see on the court. And former Democratic mayor of Miami Beach, Dan Gelber, says that he's got impeccable credentials to serve on the court. So I think it's just too early to jump in and be afraid of what's going to happen.
Yeah, I was surprised by that Dan Gelber quote, current mayor of Miami Beach. He said it's intellectually dishonest to say that these are automatically conservative votes. But, Amy, one of the issues is African-Americans upset because now we have Latinos, we have Anglos on the court, but no African-Americans for the first time in 30 years.
Yeah, I think that's a significant problem, a significant issue. But the governor's hands were tied in terms of the system that's in place with the judicial nominating system. That's a hard thing to come in and be able. He couldn't change the slate that had been put into place before he came in. Mm-hmm. He had his hand. Who knows? He expects to have other nominations. I just want to point out, everyone that he nominated is pretty young. Mm-hmm. You know, you can be a judge till you're 75, and so we're looking at decades of control here. That's gonna, I think, really shape. Think about the fights that we've had in this state, the lawsuits that have been filed, that have gone over legislation. I mean, I just see the envelope being pushed in terms of vouchers or abortion, or you name it. I mean, especially if you think about the U.S. Supreme Court and our Supreme Court and the ripple effect, there's some change
and
here.
Why we have redistricting coming up
That's
in
right.
2 years, so this court is going to rule on the new districts.
That's right.
What's your sense of where this court's going to take us? this?
Look, I have strong concerns about where we are in terms of the Florida Supreme Court. To your point, we don't have any representation of African Americans, and that was the first time since Justice Leander Shaw was appointed to the Florida Supreme Court. And then Governor DeSantis made a quote. He said, just within 2 or 3 weeks of being in office, I've already put more Hispanics on the Supreme Court than any other governor in history. We just can't do diversity to say we're doing it, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that we need to make sure that we have folks on the court who are representative of the Floridians in our state and understand the everyday struggles of Floridians. And I really do think that even though they're young, to your point, Amy, that we only have two of the three don't have more than 5 years of experience. And I think that's concerning for Florida voters who are saying, well, how are we going to get people who have the highest court in the state of Florida to rule on the issues that we face every day?
Part of this is, I think Democrats are upset in particular because the Republicans have controlled the Florida House, the Florida Senate. They've now controlled the governor's office several times in a row. They've controlled the cabinet, essentially. The one area where the Democrats had some control was in the Florida Supreme Court. Right. And they acted as a check on what was seen as Republican overreaction. And that is a concern that many Democrats now have, that check is gone and there won't be anybody to provide that sort of balance.
Danny, this Judge Muniz has never, or the new Supreme Court Justice has never been a judge.
Right.
So is that a concern? You're an attorney.
I don't think it's a concern. The reality of the matter is the Florida bar says it's a 5-year minimum of being a practicing attorney to qualify to be. It never says you have, you know, have dad been a judge. So, you know, to be a judge, you need to have good jurisprudence inside. You have to be a fair arbiter of the facts as they come before you. You know, any one of us could be a judge if we were qualified as to be an attorney, right? So to say that he's not qualified, I think he's just a red herring. Now, what he is facing today is the fact that he's gone from attorney to into the political arena, and I think the attacks on him have been wholly unfair without looking at any sort of record. I get that he doesn't have one. Let's give him a chance to make one, and then we can sit back at this very table and make these assessments, whether he's some crazy conservative or he's like some super liberal. But, you know, in between now and then, let's give the guy a chance. And the fact that he's Hispanic, I think, is a feather in the cap. You know, as we keep moving the Hispanics in Florida, we've at this table, we've talked about it, they keep growing and growing and growing, and they're reflective. I would like to see a diverse Supreme Court that is reflective of the population that it's serving, and I think that there are chances coming up to fulfill that, but let's not disregard the fact that this new governor is surprising everybody by filling the seats with minorities. I thought that was a big feather in his cap.
All right, we'll see what happens with the next appointee. Well, congressional leaders and President Trump have reached a tentative deal to reopen the U.S. government and continue talks on Trump's demand for border wall money. In an angry tone, the president made the announcement on Friday afternoon. Government shutdown lasted 5 weeks, causing many federal workers to miss two paychecks. There were long lines at some airports as screeners called in sick. Some government workers say air travel was at risk, while some air traffic controllers and security screeners were stretched to the limit. Some food was not being inspected. People who have federal housing assistance prayed that the assistance would continue. If not, they face eviction. Federal school breakfast and lunch programs are funded through March, but not beyond. Members of the Coast Guard were working without pay. Government workers went to food banks to try to make it through. And Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross said the answer is easy for workers. Just take out a loan. Well, Amy, there's a 3-week temporary settlement to this, but do you think it comes roaring back in 3 weeks?
I think that's entirely possible. I hope not, for the sake of these workers who have endured just a terrible thing for the last 30 some days. I hope they come to some agreement. Although the president said today very clearly, you know, we'll do this for 3 weeks. We'll try to negotiate. I still want my border. He didn't use the word wall. He said fence or
he said
he changed
point,
his wording a little bit.
Yeah, he said he never wanted a wall.
Yeah,
the
there
whole,
was that. but then he also said, look, I'll go the other way and you know, work around Congress and do some sort of emergency order or something. It's clear to me that he surrendered today, that he backed off. I mean, last week he made an overture that I honestly think the Democrats should at least come to the table and negotiate it over. This idea of the Dreamers, it wasn't a good offer, but it was an offer, and I think that was somewhere where I would have thought, you know, at least talk. You've got 800,000 people out of work, but you know, still here we are, and he's the one who's going to sign a bill that doesn't include anything that he started this over.
All right, so Danny, do you see it that way? Was it a surrender by the president?
I think it was a good negotiating pause. He showed you what he's willing to do. He's willing to go to the brink, and now he's like, listen, I don't need them to suffer for me to make my point, but you have seen where I'm going to go, right? So now, think about this. Those calls in Congress, those phones are going to be ringing off the hook. Get me a settlement. Get me an answer. We don't need to call him the president in chief. We just need to call him the negotiator in chief, because this guy is playing cards to a tune of, you know, families' lives were on the line. Their welfare was not good. That was a really bad situation. But when it came to getting what he wanted and doing what he promised, he showed that there is no holds barred.
All right. So, Daryl, do you agree? Do you think the president came out on top on this?
I don't think anybody came out on top. I think the American government lost as a whole. I think the American public looks at both the Congress and the presidency as inept. They have a bad enough view of politics as it stands right now, and this just made politics look even worse. So there's no doubt that the polls indicated that more people blamed Trump for the shutdown than they did Congress, but nobody came out a winner of this.
Right.
And the big loser will be if 3 weeks from now, on February 15th, we go back and have another shutdown.
Maya, do you think that's where we're heading, that this is just a temporary pause and then we'll be back in the same boat 3 weeks from today?
I think that's very possible. I mean, we've seen that Republican leadership is going to put partisanship before people. And I think it's very irresponsible to have the president of the United States use people's lives and livelihoods as a bargaining chip. He made a promise when he was running for the presidency that he was going to do a legislative matter in the executive branch of government, which is concerning. And it's interesting too, because he's even shaped how his base looks at him. There was a news article that came out where one of the government workers who said he voted for him is disappointed and that he doesn't have his trust anymore. So I think if we have to revisit this issue in 3 weeks, it's definitely going to have an impact on the 2020 elections.
All right, let's go to our next story. Progressives and fast food workers have been calling for it for years. Even some cities have already implemented it. Now, Florida's best-known trial attorney who brought us medical marijuana wants to see a gradual increase in the minimum wage statewide to $15 an hour. John Morgan says he already has 120,000 verified signatures to get his initiative on the state's 2020 ballot. That's enough to get the language of the proposed amendment reviewed by Florida's new conservative Supreme Court. The measure calls for raising the current minimum wage from $8.46 an hour to $10 an hour in 2021, with $1 an hour increases annually after that until it reaches $15 an hour in 2026. That's 7 years from now. Morgan says the increase will benefit companies through lower turnover and help taxpayers, as the government won't have to subsidize low-income workers through welfare payments. But the Florida Chamber of Commerce says small businesses would be hurt by this, what they call another new mandate, adding the state should focus on job training instead.
Maya, I'm going to go out on a limb. I'm going to say that Morgan gets it on the ballot in 2020. So let's jump ahead. Is this a good thing or a bad thing for Floridians to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2026?
Well, listen, I think, again, we're seeing that the Florida legislature isn't addressing these issues, that now we have to go to constitutional amendments to address quality of life issues. We had to do it with medical marijuana. We had to do it with environmental conservation. And the fact that we have to put in the Constitution a livable wage for Floridians is something that's supposed to be in the hand of the legislative branch of government. Raising the minimum wage is both a social justice and an economic development issue. Not saying that $15 is the magic number, but we definitely need to increase it to a livable wage, because right now, Floridians, the average median household income is $50,000, but yet the cost of living is well above that. So we definitely need to move forward. And yes, small businesses are going to have to, it's going to be an impact on small businesses, whether we do that incrementally, but we have to find a solution to where our private sector is thriving and growing, but we're not having people who can't afford to live in this state.
Well, another way to look at it, there are a lot of issues on the ballot that went there because the legislature didn't respond to them. There are a lot of things that passed this last time that I thought were bonkers, quite frankly, that didn't deserve to pass. So just because it's on the ballot and just because it passes doesn't necessarily make it good. I mean, there are some real concerns there about small businesses and mom-and-pop shops, and will you pay somebody $6 to make a burger because now you have to pay that employee $15? I mean, these are legitimate concerns of small business. There's also also self-interest on the part of John Morgan. I mean, he's a lawyer representing people. He gets a 40% contingency based on salary of individuals. Now, if you're jumping up salaries a lot, is he going to benefit financially from this? Self-interest is the definition of politics.
All right, but is this too timid? I mean, you know, because we're talking 7 years out to get to $15 an hour. Cities like Seattle have already raised the minimum wage to $15 an hour. This state would be 7 years away from that.
I think that's the only good thing about this proposal is that he's not dumb. So he goes in and he goes, look, I want $15 an hour. I've seen it happen in other places. It's brought some places to their knees where they're actually going to change going back and get away from it.
Now, who's going to change?
I think out west. Don't ask me.
I want you to come back.
Here we go. Let me write that one down. All right, let me write that down. But the reality of the matter is, if it wasn't incremental, there's no way he's going to get the support or anywhere near the support of any chamber of commerce, any middle grounder. If you've ever run a payroll and you tell me I was at $10, $11 an hour, and now I got to come up with $4, $5 more, it would crush you. Literally, it's not a political decision. It's not a political decision or discussion. It is an economic one. I couldn't afford it when I run my payroll, and I'm sure that bigger companies couldn't either.
All right. Well, before we go, what other news story should we be paying attention to? Maya, let's start with you. Your other big story.
Sure. I think coming up, we have big City of Tampa municipal elections coming up, and vote-by-mail ballots are going to be dropping soon. So I think those folks who are running for mayor and city council are going to be doing their final push, and we're going to be seeing some, hopefully, big policy ideas, or we're going to see some folks shy away from that responsibility.
All right. Daryl, your other big story?
Well, I don't often toot my own horn, but I'm tooting it. About 70 years ago, there were four individuals who were accused of raping a black woman in Groveland, Florida. And Fire in the Grove is a great book about that. It won the Pulitzer Prize. But the first actual scholarly study of Groveland was done by myself and two historians, one from the University of South Florida and one from the University of Florida. And there were these four individuals. One was shot by a sheriff's posse. One was shot by the sheriff himself when he was being returned to prison for a retrial, on which the United States Supreme Court said it was a circus trial. You had two individuals die because of this. You had the other two that spent a long time in prison, and if not for the action of some governors who commuted the sentence, and eventually it was Governor Claude Kirk who paroled these individuals, that they would have ever been freed from jail. Four lives ruined.
Good thing that our governor and cabinet pardoned them this year.
Absolutely.
Amy, your other big story?
Tampa Bay Times has a pair of stories in our online and in Sunday's paper about Hurricane Michael and the continuing recovery. One, we're following a family who owns a business there, the Driftwood Inn, and how their journey trying to rebuild. It was wiped out. They have to decide whether they're going to stay or not. The second one, we've analyzed charitable contributions to the major charities and found an amazing disparity between contributions to Hurricane Michael and previous storms, which sort of explains why it feels like it's out of the consciousness here. You know, a rural area, it was right before the election. There's some things to look at, whether these people are being overlooked.
Really? Okay. And Dan, your other big story?
All right. Story number one, never say something on Florida this week without having facts, all right, without knowing what you're talking about. Number two, though, is the story on Venezuela. It is exploding, and the Venezuelans here in both Miami, Orlando, and Tampa are leading the charge. They've got big stuff going on, and their impact is yet to be felt, but we're just starting to see the big, big rallies are coming, and they happen, and they're coming in the future. Rubio and Rick Scott have been leading the way, as well as other Democrats on board, but that's the story to be looking at, that kind of leadership right. And their impact.
Thank you all for a great show. Thanks for watching Florida This Week. Your comments are always welcome. Please write us at ftwwedu.org. Well, that was Florida This Week from this past Friday night on WEDU-TV. And my guests on that panel were Maya Brown. She was the Democrat. Danny Alvarez was the Republican. Amy Holyfield is a managing editor at the Tampa Bay Times. And Daryl Paulson is a professor emeritus at USF in St. Petersburg. And that show airs every Friday night at 8:30 on WEDU-TV. And we air the audio to that show Mondays at 11 o'clock. If you've got a comment about the show, you can call us up at 813-239-9663. You can also email us here in the studio. Our address, if you want to comment about the show, send it to dj@wmnf.org. One of the topics on that show were the changes at the Florida Supreme Court, and we're joined now by
by Sean Shaw, who's an attorney. He's the state's former insurance consumer advocate. Last year, he ran for attorney general statewide. He also has a radio show on WTMP. And Sean, welcome to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Rob, thanks for having me.
Thanks,
good to see
thanks
you.
Thanks for coming. All right, so what do you think about the three new appointees to the Florida Supreme Court?
Well, I'm conflicted. I have a lot of thoughts, as you can imagine. You ran down a little my resume, but the thing that's always most important to me is my father was Leander J. Shaw Jr. He was the first African-American Chief Justice of the Florida Supreme Court. He was appointed in the early 80s and served until 2003, and he was appointed by Bob Graham. And I say all that to say, after Bob Graham, the next governor was Lawton Chiles. That was a Democrat. And you do understand, everyone, there hasn't been a Democrat since Lawton Chiles. So all of this talk about the liberal majority on the Florida Supreme Court and all this activism, the court has already been packed. Lawton Chiles hasn't been there in a very long time. So that's the first thing I'd like to just set the context of what we're doing. Second, the Florida Supreme Court, after Governor DeSantis makes all of his picks, he's made two. I think he's got one more to make. After that third pick is made, there will be no African-Americans on the Florida Supreme Court since my dad was on the bench. And that is awful. And that's just plain not okay. And there's a lot of reasons for that. But one of the main reasons is the committees that nominate people to be on the court have been packed for all these years with appointees that want certain types of judges. So it shouldn't be any shock that the names that come out of those committees are super conservative.
How does it work that people are nominated to be on the court? And how is it? You're saying it's unfair right now?
I wouldn't say it's unfair. I just say it's very political. And, you know, when I was driving into the show, Rob, I knew one of the things I wanted to say was we're treating the Supreme Court, not only state, but federally, as a political spoil of war. And it's not. It ought to be an independent judiciary on both sides. Both sides do this. And I'm a Democrat, but both sides do this. When we win elections, we believe it is our right to now pack the courts as we see fit, rather than to pick people that have the best temperament, the best experience. And listen, we're both guilty of this, I understand, but that's not how the court ought to be. That's how Congress ought to be. That's how the presidency ought to be. But when you're talking about judges who are going to be arbitrating, and particularly in the Florida Supreme Court, life and death. Death penalty cases are going to the Florida Supreme Court. They determined who the president was essentially one year. Those ought to be judges and justices that have tremendous experience, tremendous temperament. They should not be political appointees. And the way the process works now, the governor gets to pack the committee that nominates people to the court, and you can imagine what names come out those committees.
All right, so a couple of the panelists on the show made the point, though, that Eisenhower appointed Earl Warren. Earl Warren ended up being quite a liberal in the 1960s on the U.S. Supreme Court, that you can't, and even Dan Gelber, the former state senator and the mayor of Miami Beach, said to the newspaper the other day, let's not rush to judgment. Even though they are all members of the three appointees are members of the Federalist Society, they are conservative. But Dan Gelber said, wait a minute, you can't predict what they're going to do in the future.
Two of them, at least the names I heard, have judicial experience. And even if they're very conservative, I'm okay with that. I understand elections have consequences. I don't expect you to be appointing a whole bunch of parientes to the bench that's on there now.
Who is one of the most progressive
members.
People
say is very liberal. I expect them to be conservative. That's fine, but I also expect some diversity, and I also expect some experience. I know there's one individual who his most recent experience is the general counsel to Betsy DeVos. No thanks. That I have a problem with. Now, if you have been a lawyer for 20 years and you've got a sterling reputation in your area and the judges in that area like you, I don't have a problem with someone like that being appointed to the Florida Supreme Court, even though they don't have judicial experience. But when you come from overtly political jobs, which this individual has, I forget his name, but
Carlos Muniz.
Yeah, and the general counsel to Betsy DeVos, like that, that I believe doesn't warrant you to be appointed to the Florida Supreme Court. You do know there are other courts you can get on. There's trial courts, there's the civil bench, there's appellate courts. The ultimate highest court in the state of Florida, I think, ought to be reserved for someone with a little bit more well-rounded experience.
Our guest is Sean Shaw, and last year he ran for Florida Attorney General, came close but didn't win, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Sean is a Democrat. I want to get back to the Judicial Nominating Commission. The governor has total control.
Not total, but immense. It changed because it used to be that the Florida bar had a lot of say in who what names were being sent up to these appellate benches and to the Florida Supreme Court. Their say has been watered down under Rick Scott, and it's changed that the governor has a lot more say. And I remember when I was in the legislature last year, we had a big fight about these commissions being watered down even more. And the problem is when the governor gets to a point who gives him the names, essentially the governor has tremendous power over who is coming to him to be appointed. And that's not right. We have this insulation so that the governor has to pick from a certain slate. That slate ought to be determined by the governor ought to have some say, the legislature perhaps, but the Florida Bar, which I think most people would agree is impartial. It's the organization that oversees and administrates lawyers the administration of lawyer, jurisdiction over lawyers here in Florida. They ought to have a lot of say into what name. They're the ones who practice in front of people. They're the ones who are these colleagues. They're the ones that have experience with all these people. And you're now seeing what happens when you pack the people that give you the names. You get super conservative and no black people.
The three incoming justices, Barbara Lagoa, Robert Luck, and Carlos Muniz, they all say we don't want to legislate from the bench. And they're implying that past members of the court have legislated from the bench. What do you say?
You're hitting all my soapbox points today, Rob. As I told you, Lawton Childs was the last Democratic governor. So I just want to lay that context. Democrats haven't been appointing judges in this state for almost 20-some years. These aren't our judges. These are not our people. So when you accuse people from legislating from the bench, that has the connotation that there's all these Democrats that have been appointed and they're being judicial activists. That's not the case here in Florida. We haven't had, as we've been reminded every time when governors come close but don't win in this state, we haven't had a Democratic governor in a long time. That's one. Two, it is not judicial activism when the court makes a decision that the legislative or executive branch disagrees with. That's why the court's there. So the court is there to make decisions. That's why they're appointed. That's why they're vetted. That's what they do. The legislature makes all these political, ridiculous, obnoxious decisions. And I can say that because I was there. The court is the one that decides under the Florida Constitution, the law, whether that decision comports with the law and it's appropriate. And just because they say, no, it's not, doesn't mean it's judicial activism. It means maybe the legislature went too far. Maybe the governor went too far. Particularly in this state, we have a history of the people passing constitutional amendments, the legislature doing everything it can to water it down or not do it, and then the court having to say, look, this is what the people said, do it. That's not judicial activism. Mm-hmm. That is essentially the court telling the legislature, you've gone too far. So, and three, look at the judges who are making up these decisions. These are not all straight Democrat and Republican appointees. As I said, this is a mixed court, and I think because I heard this a lot when I was in Tallahassee, and it was very troubling to me, particularly, as I said, given my history of who my father was. Judicial activism is not because you disagree with other people. That is not activism. And I would have that debate any day of the week that the Florida Supreme Court was an activist Supreme Court. It was not. It just simply was holding people accountable.
Sean Shaw is our guest. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And you are listening to 88.5 FM. Speaking of measures passed by the voters here in Florida, Amendment 4 passed overwhelmingly in November. That allows people who've served their sentences, as long as they're not murderers or guilty of sexual crimes, that allows them to automatically register to vote. But now there's talk in Tallahassee of the legislature getting involved. What are you hearing and what are your concerns?
I'm hearing the same thing, and my concern is what I just told you. The people pass these constitutional amendments and they say, look, I want automatic restoration of nonviolent felons. The governor was against that, and Attorney General Ashley Moody, who beat me, was against that. And now you're seeing Governor DeSantis say, well, I think the legislature has to implement this and we need terms to define. What is confusing about the term murder? Nothing. Murder is defined in the Florida statutes. Nothing is confusing about this amendment other than those who want to water it down and mess with it. And this state in the last 20 years has a track record of in medicinal cannabis, in the education, in the class side, in the environment. I can give you four or five examples of places where the people pass these constitutional amendments and the legislature does everything they can to thwart it. And based on that record, I am very concerned that that's what's going on now. The amendment is self-executing. If you are a nonviolent felon, you ought to be able to register to vote. And so now we're trying to have the legislature come up with a bill to define what murder is, to define what this is, to define what that is. And it's just very disappointing, all the work and all the grassroots and all the sweat and blood and tears that went into passing Amendment 4. Those people are going to just be tremendously upset and hurt, as they should, when the legislature comes up with some implementing bill that is not going to be, I don't think, what the people intended.
I want to go back to Carlos Muniz, who's the latest appointment to the Florida Supreme Court. He worked for Pam Bondi, the attorney general. How would you describe, you know, in terms of how she operated her office, how well did she serve the people of Florida? Because you were running for attorney general last year.
I see you trying to get me in deep water here, Rob. let me say this, man. I'm a Democrat, and I ran a lot of my race as kind of the opposite of Pam Bondi. But what I don't want to say is, just because you work in Pam Bondi's office, you're not qualified to be on the court. I don't want to say that. What I do want to say is, if that's all you've done, and then the next thing you did was be the general counsel to Betsy DeVos, and that's all you've done, yes, then I may have a problem with that. But I want to be clear, although I'm a Democrat, I don't have a problem with young conservative people being appointed to the bench. That's okay. That's their prerogative. But I have a problem with some of the experience of the individual we just spoke about. And I certainly have a problem that for the first time in 30 or 40 years, there's no African Americans on the Florida Supreme Court. That I have a huge problem with, and I will until we get one on there. And it's just not okay. The governor can demand. I want names that are diverse. He can send slates back. I mean, we've had litigation about this. The governor can demand from people, I want names of qualified African-Americans, qualified Hispanics, qualified women, qualified everybody. I want a diverse slate coming up to me. And while I applaud that there are now Hispanics on the bench in good numbers, I'm not going to applaud the fact that there's no African-Americans on the bench for the first time in 30, 40 years.
What's the retirement age when you're on the Florida Supreme Court?
70, I believe. 70? Yeah.
And so for all these new appointees, they're all in their, I think they're all in their 40s and 50s.
Right. They're going to be there a long time.
They're going to be a long time, probably most of our lifetimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, that's the point.
Yeah. Well, we're talking about the Florida Supreme Court with Sean Shaw. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You know, one of the cases you talked about, the past Supreme Court not being an activist court, they did turn down just recently this 10-year lawsuit against the Florida education system,
right,
against the state of Florida, because our state constitution says that we should have a uniform and a well-funded system of education statewide. Lots of teachers groups and education groups say we don't do that for every school in the state. So they sued 10 years ago. This court, or rather the past court, turned down that lawsuit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I'm one of the people that thought the lawsuit was valid, and the court disagreed and said, you know, this is the legislature's prerogative to fund education. And so simply because they disagree with my point of view, I'm not going to say, well, they're activist, and the activist court has now taken a position and I don't agree with it. No, I disagree with them. That's okay. That's how three branches of government ought to work. But that's an example, I believe, of the people in the Florida Constitution voted to say that we ought to have an adequately funded public education system. I don't believe that we do in this state currently. That's why the lawsuit was brought, and the Florida Supreme Court said, we're not going to hear this case. And that's the current Florida Supreme Court. That is not Florida Supreme Court with three new, young, conservative justices who will replace these other justices. So, yeah, I think you're going to start seeing the court probably remove itself from a lot of fights. And you're going to see a lot of decisions where they say they don't have jurisdiction. You're going to see a lot of places where a conservative bent is going to come through in their opinions. And we're going to listen, we've got redistricting coming up.
Well, let's talk about that. Redistricting. Every 10 years, the state legislature draws up new district lines for state house, state senate, U.S. Congress. And what are your concerns about that?
Well, this was one of the big examples that people gave when they were talking about judicial activism. The Florida Supreme Court admonished the legislature and the process that the legislature went through when they were doing redistricting, because it was extremely partisan. It was all hidden. They were sending secret maps back and forth. And the court said, you can't do that. Gave them a deadline to fix it. They didn't fix it. The court did it. And people were saying that smacks of judicial activism. No, that's the legislature doing the wrong thing. And someone had to come and step in under a newly constituted Florida Supreme Court. I mean, with no African-American representation on it, I'm concerned about what happens in these gerrymandered seats. What happens when someone's got to interpret what it means to have contiguous lines and what it means to have majority-minority access seats, the history of why we have those seats, All these things are important. And, you know, I said this on another show. The law is black and white, but how you interpret the law comes from your life experiences. That is why gender diversity, racial diversity, age diversity, geographic diversity is important on the on these benches. If you have everyone who has the same point of view or the same life experiences, then it's very hard for them to be able to have differing points of view on very important issues, police brutality, criminal justice, sentencing. These are things that you got to have broad diversity on the bench, and it's important, and I'm just afraid that we're missing some of that.
I think it's fair to say that young conservative Latinos are well represented on the Florida Supreme Court.
They are, and that's good. But we also ought to have some, and I'm sure they can find conservative young African Americans.
813-239-9663. Let's start taking some phone calls. Gino's in Tampa. Gino, you've got a question for Sean Shaw?
Sure. I went to school with a young man, good friend of mine. His name is Mike Andrews. He's in the Tampa Bay area. He was in the newspaper as being considered one of those judges. What happened, if you know?
Mike Andrews. Does that name ring a bell?
I couldn't hear it. I'm sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. He was asking about a young guy named Mike Andrews, who was an up-and-coming attorney.
He's a judge in St. Pete.
A judge in St. Pete.
For years. Yeah. So I was asking the question, and he was also in the newspapers tapped as one of those three Tampa Bay area judges being considered for the Supreme Court. Do you all know what happened?
I know there is some geographic requirements depending on what justice retires and from what geographic area they're from. So I know there is some correlation there. But listen, I agree. I don't know what to tell you, man. As I said, geographic diversity is important. Gender, race, all that's important. And what is really disappointing to me, though, because you see it in Washington, D.C. even more pronounced, these are political trophies. Seats on these Florida, on the Supreme Courts of states and of the United States, we're treating them as political trophies. And when you win, you get that trophy. And now that seat is yours to do with what your political party wants. That's just not how it ought to be done. And listen, I'm not absolving the Democrats from this either. We do it as well. But that is disappointing. The judicial branch is where we should not infect it with politics. There's a reason that the founding fathers gave lifetime appointments to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's because they didn't want political stuff infecting the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, we're saying, if you can tell me that politics hasn't infected these judicial nominations, then I'll tell you you're looking at something way different than I'm looking at.
All right, Gino, thanks a lot. Thank you. All right, and again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. You know, continually the Florida Supreme Court has ruled in favor of a woman's right to choose because we have a privacy amendment in our state constitution. Is that right to choose, do you think? Is that up for grabs? Is that in danger now, now that we've got a new Supreme Court?
I don't think so. It is enshrined in our Florida Constitution. Like you said, we have a privacy provision here in Florida that is more than what's in the federal Constitution, which is why a lot of these women's right to choose attack bills that the Florida legislature passes aren't successful. But you did throw me in the briar patch because I got to give a shout out to my dad again, because it was his decision decades ago that interpreted that privacy provision to apply in cases involving a woman's right to choose. And when he did that, and I'm getting somewhere with this story, when he did that, pissed a lot of people off. And so when he was up for merit retention, there was a vigorous campaign against him because he took that position. So that's why judges also in this state run for merit retention. So they are not completely insulated from the people. They every 6 years have to run for merit retention. None has ever lost. But they are somewhat accountable to the people.
Sean Shaw is our guest, and you're listening to WMNF in Tampa. You know, the state of Florida has this limit on how much you can obtain when you sue the state. And I think the limit is something like $300,000.
It's $250,000.
Is it $250,000? Yeah. There's all these lawsuits that are coming up now from Parkland, and there's other lawsuits, too, trying to sue the state for negligence. There's some people who've had their kids in foster in a state program, and the kids were killed when they were in a state program. But now all the Parkland lawsuits are going to come up, and they're going to sue the state and try to get damages. Is that cap unfair? Is that a cap of $250,000?
I've always thought the cap was unfair, and I'll tell you why. It is my belief, and it won't surprise you because I'm a plaintiff's attorney, it is my belief that a jury can adequately determine what damages ought to be. We allow a jury to determine whether you go to jail or not. We allow a jury to determine whether you are sentenced to death or not. And you're telling me they're not qualified to determine whether your thing is worth $200,000 or $500,000? That's nonsense. A jury of your peers is capable, quite capable of determining what damages ought to be apportioned without such an artificial cap, in my opinion.
And if you sue the state and win, and you're awarded more than the cap allows, more than $250,000, you have to file a bill in the legislature.
You got to file a claims bill in the Florida legislature. And that, listen, I still don't know the process, and I was up there. It is the most arbitrary, strange. You got to get a lobbyist probably to help you through the process. And it is very just strange and difficult to try to go up in Tallahassee, as you can imagine, and get a claims bill heard, number one, passed, number two.
Let's go to Mike in St. Petersburg. Mike, you're on with Sean Shaw. What's your question?
Hi, yes. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, that $250,000 was really a gimmick that was put in place to make it less lucrative for attorneys to take cases and sue, and so that's kind of why I always thought they put that in place.
Well, he's right. That's exactly why they put it in place. That doesn't mean it's right.
Yeah.
I mean, there's tons of things, and again, I'm a plaintiff's attorney, so it won't surprise you that I say this. There's tons of things that Tallahassee does to limit what plaintiff attorneys do because we are the ones that represent injured people. So rather than to deal, in my opinion, rather than deal with the underlying issues are with the case and how to fix maybe corporate actions, they limit what an attorney can do.
How is that number not arbitrary, you know? I mean, it's just like they just picked an arbitrary number.
Bingo.
Yeah,
I agree.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. That was your question, right?
Yep.
All right, Mike, thanks a lot. Yeah, all right. Sean, are you out of politics?
That's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, I got a radio show. I'm about to roll out a 501c4 advocacy organization that's going to take positions on issues that I care about that are important to me. Voting rights, the environment, particularly corporate and workers' rights is something that's very important to me. And we're going to roll that out in early February. But I think what you're asking is, am I planning on running for something anytime soon? And right now, no. I'm enjoying not being elected, not running for anything. And I'm working for Vanguard attorneys right now, so I like where I'm at. And for right now, we're just going to do that. And I'm not saying no to something in the future, but what I am saying is I'm recharging the batteries a little bit.
It's got to be tough running statewide.
We can have a show on that.
Let's go to Willie, who's in Tampa, wants to talk about Amendment 4. Willie, what's your question? Hi, Willie, you're on WMNF.
First of all, I would like to make a statement before I ask my question, if I may.
Sure, please.
First of all, I'm not a lawyer, but I'm a paralegal, and I was certified pursuant to Hooks v. Wainwright. And I think in the judicial system, I have won more cases than most lawyers because, at least 95% of the cases in his are kind of by plea negotiation. So to be a lawyer here today, it goes back to Santa Bella versus New York in 1980. Most cases are by plea negotiation. So I know a little bit about law. And first of all, I'm not a yellow dog Democrat. I vote for the person. Whether Republican or Democrat, those that work for the interest of the common person. So, and I am an ex-offender. I have all of my rights restored. I'm a member of the NRA. I don't believe in everything they teach. And I do have a weapon permit. Now, my question is this. We know that Amendment 4 passed by about, 65%?
Right. Yeah.
And we have 1.4 million ex-offenders. All of them have family members. We also have 100,000 people who are incarcerated in the Department of Correction. And Attorney Shaw knows that the last time he was at your station, I gave him my 10% rule, which he could have won the election, he and Mayor Gillen. But my question is this. If you have 1.4 million ex-offenders, and maybe all of them can't vote, but in Hillsborough County, I doubt that we had 500 to go and register to vote that could have voted, and we have over 10,000 ex-offenders living here in Hillsborough County and
right.
Petersburg.
And Willie, now, Willie, I'm sorry, we're out of time. We got 30 seconds, Sean. What would you say back to
I would Willie? Say, thank you, Reverend Dixon. I know who this is. I think his question is, why haven't more registered? We got to make sure they do it. Listen, they're going to have the same problem as people that are not ex-offenders registering. Like, there's voter apathy. I don't want to do it. And you tell me why it's important. We got to convince them that we fought this hard to get them involved. We got to make sure they do it. Otherwise, the fight was for naught.
Sean, thanks a lot for coming by WMNF.
Yeah,
I hope you come back.
You invite me, I'll come back.
All right, and you're on WTMP on Saturday.
WTMP noon on Saturday's Vanguards of Democracy radio show, and we're going to have all the city council and mayoral candidates on there in my upcoming shows.
All right, well, it's great to have you here.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Sean Shaw is a former candidate for attorney general, former member of the state legislature. If you want to comment about today's show, you can call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 115, and I'll play your comments back tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Stay tuned for Midpoint with Sean Shaw. He's got some information about those Tampa City Council candidates. This is WMNF Tampa St. Petersburg.